ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय, ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय, ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय, ओम ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुर्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। नाम श्रेष्ठं मनुमपि शचीपुत्रमात्रस्वरूपं रूपं तस्याग्रमुर्भुरीं माथुरीं गोष्ठवतीं राधाकुण्डं गिरिवरमहो राधिकामाधवाशं प्राप्तो यस्य प्रथितो कृपया श्रीगुरुं तं नतोऽस्मि। वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरो श्रीयतः पदकमलं श्रीगुरुन् वैष्णवांश्च श्रीरूपं साग्रजातं सहगणरघुनतन्वितं तं सजीवं साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजनसहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधा कृष्णपादान् सहगणललिता शिवशाखान्वितांश्च। हरे कृष्णा हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम हरे राम 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 हरे हरे। Yesterday I finished my discussion of the name Tirthankar. There's one question relating to something I said in that series of talks, on which I'll expound and go into some other topics, which isn't really related to Tirthas very much. The question was that I had said something that a certain scholar... I'll rephrase the question because it's not, as far as I remember, not exactly what I said, but that Tirtha Yatra became very popular at a certain point when yagyas were becoming less prominent, performing yagyas, or the performance of major public yagyas became less popular. There's some idea like this. As people started to go on Tirtha Yatras, in which the common people can directly partake, whereas in yagyas, common people, most of them, only indirectly. And along with the question, I'd said that we should give credit where it's due. That was referring to scholars. Which period is being referred to here? Is it the period after the appearance of Vaishnava acharyas like Ramanuja? No, I don't think so. It's not very clear when it was. Definitely Tirtha Yatra has been there since time immemorial. We find Vidura is mentioned, and even in the much more recent times, long before Ramanuja, Shankara. Was he exactly going on Tirtha Yatra? No, it's more like a Digvijay Yatra. But naturally that took him. Digvijay Yatra means he went out to conquer over others. A king goes on Digvijay Yatra by conquering over others by the strength of his weapons and his army. And a scholar goes on Digvijay Yatra to defeat others on the strength of his learning and logic and noetic abilities. This scholar didn't say that pilgrimage was something new, but that it became more popular. But anyway, it didn't state the period. And the scholars, they may be very vague about all these things. Anyway, the scholars, they deal in speculations. That they can be very favorable to our movement and helpful and give certification, this is a bona fide movement. In late 1966, early 1977, I believe that was the first time where that happened in a big way, that our movement in America was under tremendous pressure because there were big court cases against our movement. saying that it's brainwashing and kidnapping people. And many scholars, they came forward, prominent scholars, Harvey Cox, he was very well known at the time. He was one of the most prominent theologians of the 20th century, at least in the English-speaking language and in America. And Harvey Cox came forward, and Diana Eck, who must have been they must have all been quite young at the time. I believe Harvey Cox and Diana Eck are still alive. And some others, I can't remember, maybe Larry Shin, maybe not. I can't remember all the names. But many of them came forward and said, no, this is a bona fide religion. And which was, for scholars less than Harvey Cox, who was well established, it was a bold thing to do, because there was so much pressure against the devotees, and the newspapers were against the devotees, mostly, not giving them a fair say. But they risked public reprisal, maybe not reprisals, but being mocked. And I'm not sure what the atmosphere was in the academia at that time, but at the present time, if you say something which is not politically correct, you'll lose your tenure or your job if you don't have a tenure. So they stood out and stepped out and spoke out. You could say at risk to themselves, at least social risk, if. So they felt very strongly, and they also felt strongly about the issues of freedom of speech, freedom of religion. So it wasn't just that they were defending our movement. But in this way, they can be very favorable to our movement and supportive. And Srila Prabhupada, he had his disciples who, first of all, he engaged disciples in distributing standing orders of his books to libraries and colleges. Standing orders meant that Srila Prabhupada was translating them, the Bhagavatam. I believe when the library program began, that the standing orders, the Bhagavatam was issued up to the fourth canto only. And the idea was that the libraries or scholars or whoever take whatever books are there now, and then whenever new books are published, you send it to them and they'll pay for it. Standing order. So Srila Prabhupada, he specifically wanted that these books be available to the more educated and intellectual class of people. And he had his disciples collect reviews for his books. And he had a book published called The Krishna Consciousness Movement is Authorized, in which there were many quotes from established scholars. The reviews weren't all 100% favorable, but the ones that were published were at least 90% favorable. And Thomas Hopkins, he's most, maybe among all the scholars, the most favorable. Joseph O'Connell, he also stood out at that time. He's passed away now. But when he first got the books, he couldn't believe it, because he was one of the first scholars to study Gaudiya Vaishnavism in the Western world, one of the first scholars to do that. And then he heard about Prabhupada. He was somewhere in Pennsylvania, I believe. And he heard about Prabhupada being in New York, so he went there and he saw the three volumes of the first canto of Bhagavatam, and he couldn't believe his good luck, because he didn't have a good translation, only some very rough translation. And here's a translation with commentary. And he thought, and I believe it was him who said, one of the best features about the Krishna Conscious Movement is that you can get these books in the airports, which were previously not available anywhere, and now you can get them everywhere. So he was very pleased with that. So they can be very favorable, but they're in their own space. They're not devotees, so to speak. Although Thomas Hopkins, I think next time around, he's going to have to be a devotee. He's almost there. I saw a video clip of some conference in which he was talking about the movement and this. It was a conference organized by devotees with all scholars. And at the end he said, and the most important thing he said is, go for it. Do your Krishna consciousness. Go back to Godhead. He was preaching to the devotees. And last thing I like to say, hurry bowl. So he's almost there. He did a lot of service and is doing. But at the same time, their sympathy, it's on a cultural level. They have a different outlook. Their methodology and outlook is radically different to and actually opposed to ours. Because our outlook, or those who are the insiders, the emic approach to anthropology, if you want to, practically the scholars, what they're doing, they're studying us as anthropologists. The emic approach is that we accept the tradition as it is. We accept Vyasadeva as a real person who actually lived 5,000 years ago, and he organized the Vedas, which are eternally existing, and had the Puranas, gave to his disciples. He is the editor and the divider of the Vedic literature. Now, scholars don't believe this. They say their framework is it's derived from Darwinian evolutionary theory, and then the gradual evolution of societies, and mostly they think that, well, the Bhagavatam, it definitely after Christ, for sure. Otherwise, how can it speak of Buddha? Buddha came before Christ, but then there's, what is that? Kikateshu Bhavishyati. Anjana Sutta, Buddha, Kikateshu will be appear in the Kikata. Bhavishyati, will happen. It's a prediction, because the Bhagavatam comes before Buddha. But they say, no, that's they're pretending. What the scholars will say is that actually it's composed after Buddha. Otherwise, how could they know? Because they don't believe in Trikalagya. Vyasas can see three phases of time, past, present, and future. They don't believe that. So they say that it was composed before, but actually it was composed later, which is very atheistic from our perspective. But they like us on a cultural level, and yeah, it's good, it's nice. And they may spend time in Vrindavan or Varanasi or wherever, and they like it. It's good, you know, it's fun, and it's traditional, and yeah, it's great. But they don't believe it. As scholars, they have to remain etic. Emic means studying from the inside. And actually, we're not emic, because that's for anthropologists. They study from the inside. But we're not. But studying from the inside means you're still outside, because you come to study. We come to practice. We don't come for sociological or psychological analysis. We accept sarvametadritang manye. We accept everything that Krishna says as truth. So they're sympathetic on a cultural level, but they have their own take on Shastra and on the whole tradition. They don't take it as sacred as we do. They may defend our right to treat it as sacred, but they themselves cannot take it as sacred. Satsuru Maharaj, he recalled, I believe in his book ISKCON in the 1970s, how doing this library program, he got to meet so many scholars of Indology and so on. And he was invited to a meeting of all big scholars, informal meeting. And he thought, oh, that's very exciting. They'll be discussing so many scholarly things. But they got, so he was there and they got together. But it was not, it was an informal meeting, and they were drinking, and they were, they were just joking around irreverently. And then the high point was when someone told, one of the scholars told a long story about how he and someone else he was traveling with, they came to a narrow river which you could easily cross over, a rivulet, but because they were stoned on marijuana, ganja, they thought it was a huge river. That was the highlight. Mahabodhi also told me, he was on the library party, once he went into the office of a big Indology professor in America at 10 o'clock in the morning. The man was flat out lying on his table, completely drunk. And then someone else told me, I think that was Kala Kanta, or was it Mahakram? Maybe both of them, they went together. They were in England at that time, and they went to some Oxford University. So they were looking for some professor at Oxford University, famous professor of Indology. They couldn't find him in his office, couldn't find him in the... They found him in the bar with one hand around a girl and the other hand with beer. So, it's not very good association. They may be very scholarly. What it is, they find out a little bit of information here, a little bit of information there. They study some old shastras. They make some linguistic analysis. They study iconography. And they come up with their theories, which are based, again, on the idea that, well, there was a big bang and then everything, amazingly, fell into place. And then... Then life appeared by random combination of chemicals, and then there were gradually human beings developed, and here we all are today to study all these things. They can be very learned in our shastras, maybe even more than we are, because they're scholars. That's what they do. They're intelligent people, and if they're an expert in Chaitanya Charitamrita, among the scholars, the edition of Chaitanya Charitamrita they prefer to use is Ed Dimmock's edition. He was a scholar. Ed Dimmock and Tony Stewart, his assistant. They don't like, and Ed Dimmock he criticizes Prabhupada because he says it's Prabhupada's edition because he says it is, what's the word he uses? I can't remember, but he gives the idea that it's proselytizing, it's promoting a certain, whereas his idea is you should just study it. But Chaitanya Charitamrita itself is a proselytizing text. It's meant for devotees and it's meant to encourage them to spread the message to other devotees. Jare deko tare kaha Krishna upadesh amaragyai guru haya tara edesh. But they don't like that. They think, you know, you should take it and just like you put a butterfly and you look at it with a magnifying glass. And that's the... They don't consider it to be very authorized, Prabhupada's edition. To impress the scholars, so to speak, one has to be on a high level of scholarship. You have to know what you're talking about. Otherwise, you won't impress them very much. Just like Thomas Hopkins, the first time he went to visit the devotee, he wanted to see Prabhupada. He couldn't see Srila Prabhupada at that time. He met some of his disciples. I don't think any were initiated at that time. It was very early days of the movement. And he asked the devotee who might have been just around for 2 or 3 days, it seems like that, because he asked him, well, do you have anything about Lord Chaitanya? Lord Chaitanya, who's that? He said, well, he was in Bengal, and he had not heard of Bengal either. So he'd not heard of Lord Chaitanya, not heard of Bengal, but he said, oh, here's some books. And here are the books, the Bhagavatam, with the Devanagari text, word-for-word translation, verse translation, commentary, and what a difference between this or someone who knows nothing and the Bhagavatam translated with a scholarly commentary. Scholarly here I mean by devotional scholar. There's a big difference. So he couldn't work out how there was such a big gap until he met Prabhupada. And he realized that Prabhupada is imparting He couldn't realize how they were so enthusiastic and so dedicated and at the same time so ignorant. Then when he met Prabhupada, he understood that Srila Prabhupada was what Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur would call a living source. Anyone who contacts him becomes infected. Or like electric. Anyone who comes in contact becomes electrified. So definitely the scholars, they can do relevant research and bring up all kinds of... Mostly they bring up all kinds of questions which then devotees should reply to. One of the major things is their idea that Sanskrit is not the mother language of everything. There's the Aryan invasion, and there was a prototype Indo-European language from which all Indian languages, not the South Indian languages, but the languages of North India and the languages of Europe, they both derive from an early language which is now lost. There's no record of it whatsoever, but it's surprising, isn't it, that we find so many words in English and pretty much all European languages which are similar to those in Sanskrit. Now what's the reason for that? Well, one reason could be that Sanskrit is the mother of all languages, but we don't want to think like that, because there was, how could that be? Because the people who spoke this language came from outside India, the Aryan invasion theory. And so they say, well, there must have been, these people who invaded, they must have had a prototype Indo-European language, which would have been called something different. There's no record of it whatsoever, but it's firmly embedded in the scholars' minds, because they couldn't admit that Sanskrit is the mother of all languages. And even in their own anthropological analysis, they understand that a language which, the more complex a language it is, it signifies a higher level of thought and civilization. So Sanskrit is, it's Sanskrit, it's perfectly made. There's no language like it in the world, which is so perfectly organized. And the whole idea of examining languages and grammatical roots and so many things, the Europeans never even thought of it until they came to India and saw that. And what to speak of the language itself, the subject matter, there are all kinds of topics discussed about organization of society, metallurgy, medicine, all kinds of things are discussed, which and architecture, so many things. And then there's advanced mathematics, astronomy, and these are all signs of a very high civilization. But the British invaders were envious. They didn't want to admit that there was a better civilization than ours, and they cooked up this whole theory, and that everything that the Indians have, it must be borrowed from somewhere else, like their astronomy and astrology. It must have come from the Greeks, which means it's after the Greeks. And they've cooked up a whole theory which is wrong and envious, but it's difficult to counteract them. It requires a big scholarly endeavor to counteract that, and so far some kind of effort is going on with Rajiv Malhotra, but at the same time it seems to me he's not fully convinced himself of the authenticity, especially of the Puranas. He and his followers, they're a bit mixed up with the Western scholarly ideas. So we should be very careful about taking their findings seriously. Some of the things they say may be true. Some of them not. A lot of them not. And we should be careful about associating with them too closely. We want them to be favorable to our movement. If possible, we'd like to influence them to be Krishna conscious, but it's very difficult because they're very strongly set in a certain mindset, and their whole career and it all developed. It all depends on that. There was one scholar, some Australian lady, went to study in the Radharaman temple and studied everything and wrote a book, and then she became a devotee, and she, as far as I know, she lives there most of the time. So that can happen when someone decides, I'd rather be on the inside than the outside. But it doesn't happen much, because then you have to leave behind all your friends and your scholarship and your career and your whole mindset. So we know we shouldn't want to be like them. Unfortunately, what has happened is some devotees from our ISKCON have stepped into the academic world with the aim of influencing it, and probably they have in some positive ways. But at the same time, to be allowed in that world, you have to become part of it to a large extent. I remember Bhakti Vignavinashana Maharaj, who used to serve under Tamal Krishna Goswami. He told me that Tamal Krishna Maharaj had told him that when Tamal Krishna Maharaj first went to university, that he submitted an essay, and the professor, who was a lady, got on his case and said, you can't write like this. This is all Hare Krishna style. You can't bring all this here. So he had to develop a more objective style, which is in line with the scholars, what they think is proper. And it goes to such an extent that we find that two of them, actually most respected devotees in our movement, they brought out an edition of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Because what had happened, they'd been discussing with scholars about Bhagavatam, and then one of them asked them, well, where's the Bhagavatam? And they didn't say, well, here it is, Prabhupada's Bhagavatam. They thought, oh, we don't have a Bhagavatam we can show to the scholars. So they made their own edition. And in that they say it was probably written around 500 AD or something like this, which is atheism. Because if you think it was written after 500 AD, first of all, you think all the acharyas are wrong. All Prabhupada was wrong in saying that it was 5,000 years ago. 500 AD, that means where's Vyasadeva? If Vyasadeva came at 500 AD, then he made this thing up about Buddha coming later. It comes to atheism. Instead of influencing them to get the right idea, you've become part of the wrong idea, and you bring it back into our ISKCON. So the bad influence of mundane scholarship on our movement it may be quite subtle, but it undermines everything. We're supposed to have what? Sarvam etad ritang manye yan mang vadasi keshava. We have to. Arjuna, this Prabhupada, he quotes this in his introduction to Bhagavad Gita. We have to accept Bhagavad Gita as Arjuna accepted it. How does Arjuna accept it? With full faith that everything Krishna says is completely true. But then, what do we accept? Is part of Bhagavad Gita, which was written by Vyasadeva, well, maybe Vyasadeva didn't exist. Or maybe it was written much later, they're all different theories. And where does the Bhagavad Gita come from then? It's just, it's not Krishna, Krishna 5,000 years ago, it's not, it's just, we can't accept all these ideas. And it comes to atheists, it's subtly, it comes in. So I would say to such devotee scholars, just choose what you want to be, just be in that camp or be in this camp, but it's hypocritical or deceitful to, when you're with the scholars, you talk, yes, yesterday, 5,000 years, 500 AD, and oh, those funny people, they believe it's 5,000 years ago. They may not say that, but it's implied that those who believe it was 5,000 years ago, They're just some religious fanatics who don't really know things. They don't accept the evidence that we have by linguistic analysis and whatever. So you go and join them, or come here and be part of us, but don't bring this poison in. Very, very dangerous. Also, with interfaith, that's another area in which devotees meet with scholars of different faiths. Well, the very word faith, of course, Srila Prabhupada didn't like that. When he was asked, what do you believe? He says, we don't believe, it's a fact. It's not a question of belief. It's not that someone believes 2 plus 2 equals 4. It's a fact. So reincarnation is a fact. God is a fact. Krishna is a fact. It's not a question of belief. If you think it's belief, then you can change it. You can change from one belief to another, but the fact remains the same. You may believe 2 plus 2 equals 3, but the fact remains the same, that 2 plus 2 equals 4. So the very term interfaith means it's pretty inauspicious for us to get into that kind of thing, because when you meet with other people, you say, well, we believe this, and then you believe that. And what's the absolute truth? That was recounted by one devotee in Canada. He recounted to Srila Prabhupada that he went to an interfaith meeting, and they're speaking so many things, and then it was his turn to speak. He said, so far we've been speaking about different beliefs, now let's discuss what is the absolute truth. And they didn't like that. What is the beginning of our entry to understanding? Atato Brahma Jignasa. Now we should discuss the absolute truth. They don't like it. As long as it's on the card, oh, you believe that? Oh, that's very interesting. And we believe this. Oh, it's very interesting. So it all becomes relative. Instead of understanding the absolute truth, it all becomes relative. Interfaith discussions, yeah, we're not looking for enmity with people of other faiths or other convictions, let's put it like that. And yeah, if there's some appreciation from that side, but then we also have to appreciate what they do and say, then if we're going to appreciate, we might not be able to bring up the topic. Well, you eat meat, don't you? You slaughterhouse meat. It's too sensitive. Then you can't say it, which was one of the first things Srila Prabhupada used to say to Christians when he met with them. But if you're going to have an interfaith discussion, you have to keep the mood very cordial. But if you really want to get into it, you would find that the interfaith discussions, they become stymied by faith. You can only go so far without offending others or infringing on what they consider to be sacred. For instance, if you're talking with a Christian and you say that, well, actually, how can you accept Jesus as God? He didn't say he's God. That came later. And then if he agrees with you, then he stops to be a Christian, because that's the most basic article of faith in Christianity, is that Jesus is God. So you can't really discuss any matters of any real import. You can discuss, well, how do you pray, and this and that, what do you think about this and that, and we should all light a candle for peace and other useless things like that. But any deep discussion, you can't do that. You can't. So interfaith, it's for making friends with members of various faiths who agree to discuss with you. Because a real hardcore Christian, they don't even discuss. It's just Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, finished. You're a representative of Satan. That's what we are, according to... Especially if you're in the West and you're preaching. Here in India also, there are so many Christians now. They can't hear you. You is Satan. The devil is in you. They can't begin to hear. Hare Krishna. Unfortunate. So we have to be very careful about making adjustments with the atheistic ethos or the semi-religious ethos, to the extent that we lose our real identity just by being nice and not speaking the message, then we become influenced. Being nice, yes, we should be nice to people. There's no need to be unnecessarily rude and this and that. But if we want to accommodate ourselves to the ethos of the world, whatever that might be, there are so many. I mean, basically it's eating, sleeping, mating and defending, but in various ways. That's called different cultures. Different cultures means different approaches to eating, sleeping, mating and defending. And maybe there's some religion thrown in. Yeah, and many of them there's religion thrown in also. Just like I'm told that if we go to the websites of certain ISKCON centers in Australia, you'll find that we're gay-friendly, is written there. Because people want to know. It's just like if you go to if you go to the websites of various senators and Congress people, I guess you call them, Congress members in the United States, that means governmental representatives, they'll put what is their position on various issues, because various issues are important to people in America, just like abortion. Are you for abortion or against it? Pro-life or pro-choice? And they have to write it there so people can know. And are you pro-capital punishment or against? But abortion is one of the big ones. Oh, gay rights is another one. another of the big issues. So so I'm told some of the temples in Australia say we're gay-friendly, or well, we shouldn't be gay unfriendly in the sense that we go around beating them up or something. But that's from a previous generation, at least in the country I was raised in. It's probably still going on in Russia, but it's probably not going on in England, because the children in school are told, yeah, it's all good, whatever, it's all nice, everything good. So the ethos has changed, but I'm just making the point here to be accepted by the broader public, we shouldn't change our teachings to become part of that. then we're selling our soul. We lost our own identity. In this regard, I'm going to discuss something, because I saw on Dandavat website some time ago, there was a photograph and a little report on one of the prominent devotees in Britain. I think it was Gauri Das Prabhu, or maybe it was Kripa Moy, I can't remember. And there was a photo of them. They'd been invited to speak or visit. And again, I don't remember exactly what it was. I think it's something to do with the Royal Navy, maybe Royal Navy officer cadet, something like that. But it was very establishment. Now, establishment is a word I don't think you can translate into any Indian language. It means the leaders of society, or the top leaders and those who are in support of that, which means people who are for the present, for the status quo in society, the parliament, the police force, the army, the navy, universities, maybe, because some university professors are anti-establishment. But it now going and speaking to them means that, to some extent, at least, we accept their values, or at least it seems like that. It may not necessarily be so. So should we go if we're called to such meetings? I would say, having just said that it indicates that we accept some of their values, I would say, yeah, if we're called, probably we should go. Because the establishment has great power to either help us or to suppress us. An example of that is that Some years ago, the establishment, now when we say the establishment, there are different, not that everyone has exactly the same opinion on everything, but our movement was seen as anti-establishment when it was first started, because hippies were, the whole idea of being a hippie was anti-establishment, anti-status quo. So most of the devotees were hippies, and they had, many of them had hippie attitudes, and they didn't mind, they thought it was fun getting in clashes with the police, as long as they were minor, like this. Now, in Britain in the 80s, 90s, there was the local village, most of the villages in which the Bhaktivedanta Manor, just outside London, was situated, they wanted to close the manor. So it became a big fight, legal fight, political fight. Political includes also the fifth column, which means the press and everything. And for the first time in history, and maybe the last time also, the Indian immigrants, Hindus, they made a big march in London to show solidarity with the Manor campaign to keep it open. And that made a big impression. Because because the establishment, the leaders, know, well, the Indians, they're very good citizens. They're not the kind of people who make riots, or they're good, hardworking, mostly well educated. They're with the establishment, but they're against us on this issue. And things changed, and now every Diwali is celebrated in the House of Commons. And usually, I believe, or maybe in 10 Downing Street, the residence of the Prime Minister. The Queen visited Bhaktivedanta Manor. That's pretty big, isn't it? The previous Prime Minister of Britain, David Cameron, he also visited. Visited means that he gave some speech or something. Now, they're not coming because they think we want to be a Hare Krishna, but they're coming because they think the Indian vote is important for us. And their money, we want them, they're also well-to-do. We want to be seen as open-minded. And then the present Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, he also came. So, do we want that or not? Well, some people would say, well, we sold out. We used to be anti-establishment, now we're pro-establishment. We're not really for it or against it, but I remember the example of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who, when practically all of Bengal was against the British, he was saying, no, why do we want to get involved in politics? The British, they're not doing us any harm. And they went along with them. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati brought the governor of Bengal, Sir John Anderson, to Mayapur. And he came. So it wasn't exactly that they ratified everything the British did, but they saw that by the grace of God, they are the rulers, and as the citizens, it is our duty to go along with the rulers as long as they don't harass us. We see Sanatana Goswami, even though he went against the Nawab, he respected him as a representative of God. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Naranang Chandaradhipam, among men, I am the ruler. So somehow or other, for better or worse, they are representatives of God, and we don't have business getting involved in politics, so as long as they let us do our work, then we're fine with that. And we should, as we may be sadhus, but it's our duty as citizens to support the status quo. We may not believe in it, we may not support everything they do, but in general, at the present time, that's the way the status quo is, and we should accept that. Although we remember also Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when the Qazi broke the Madanga and stopped the Sankirtan, or tried to, then Nimai Pandit, he protested. So if they directly intervene to stop our core activities, then we should resist that. But if by facilitating them, and accepting their position, they'll allow us to do that, which now we can. It used to be in London when I joined in 1975. Whenever we went out for Harinam Sanctan, the police would come and arrest us. Nowadays, we just go and they don't say anything. So times have changed. That's good, isn't it? I mean, there are pros and cons. We'd prefer to have Maharaj Yudhishthira as the king of the world or someone who's like him, but we're a long way from that. And Srila Prabhupada, he strongly criticized various leaders, but he sought to influence them also. Scholars, Prabhupada liked to meet with scholars, religious leaders, political leaders he didn't meet with so much. He would have done if they'd come to him. And political leaders have helped this movement in bigger ways, smaller ways. We heard that, when Harikesh and Kirti Raj, and they're about to be, the KGB wanted to arrest them, and it came up to, they weren't sure whether to do it or not, because it's a big thing to arrest American citizens in Russia, becomes a big thing. Big international issue. And it came up to Brezhnev, and Brezhnev asked his advisor, who was some Russian mystic woman, and she said, no, they're good people, let them go. And he let them go. And the KGB wanted to arrest them. We found them, we got them. We won't get this opportunity again, but Brezhnev let them go. There are so many big people who have been influenced or done good things for this movement. If you're from the Western world, you must have heard the name of Mick Jagger, who's not a symbol of goodness by any means. But he also gave some donations to the various. George Harrison did so much service. The list goes on and on. John Lennon, Paul McCartney, so many singers. Bob Dylan, I don't even know the names of them all. Then there was Tom Dryden, was an MP in England. He was helpful. Bill Clinton, at least seems to like our movement, from what we understand. Donald Trump, he owned some land, some open lot in New York City, which was just in the right spot where we could assemble the Rath Yatra cart. And devotees went to him to get permission if they could use it. You can't go to him directly. He was a huge businessman. This was 40 years ago, more. He was a young man then, but he was a big businessman, self-made. So his secretary said, there's no way he'll agree with this, but I'll give you they brought a pack of prasadam and a letter and said, okay, I'll give it to him, but he'll say no. He said, no way he's going to say yes. And then she phoned up 3 days later and said, I don't know what happened, but he took a bite of that food you gave, looked at the letter and said, sure, why not? Come and get the authorization letter. Donald Trump ki jai. No one else said jai. Well, maybe Krishna's saying. At least the devotees at that time, they were saying jai. They were very happy. So many big people. Yeah, the Prince Charles, once he was in India, there was some dance show going on. Devotees had given him Bhagavad Gita. During the dance show, he's looking at the Bhagavad Gita, not at the dance, some Indian dance. You know, wherever he goes, they show some local dance, and he was reading Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita. And so many people have done service in so many ways. Scholars. So even though we may strongly oppose some of their policies, for instance, having slaughterhouses. In this country there are slaughterhouses. What does that mean? We should go completely against the government? No. We should honor them for whatever they're honorable for, and our opposition goes on in different ways, by distributing books, giving talks in which we discuss this thing. If you come out so strongly against them, then they may close you down and you can't talk at all. We recognize Krishna and put them in charge, but we don't want to get diverted into making political agitation. We don't want to be dictated by them. We want to influence them, which might be gradual. We don't expect that, you know, someone comes up, oh, it's a Hare Krishna, and okay, I'll stop everything and listen to you. And it's not going to be like that. They may even come to our temple. They don't come to hear any message. We'll give them a Bhagavad Gita. But they come for their own reasons, and when we give them a Bhagavad Gita, what can we do? We may tell them, these are our teachings. It might be gradual. We want to influence them, but then we have to go on with our Harinam Sankirtan, our book distribution. If we hadn't done these things, then the political leaders wouldn't take any notice of us. If we were just sitting in a cave somewhere and not preaching, then why would they take any notice of us? Because they're taking some notice because we're having some effect. So we welcome, to some extent, their support and protection, and they may also give donations. At least Parashuram in London is doing his Hare Krishna Food for All. He gets donations from local government agencies. He's distributing prasadam and very openly Hare Krishna. They know it's Hare Krishna. They give. You take the food, cook it, they offer it. They don't make any secret that they're offering it to Krishna. But we have to be careful. We have to be very careful. Srila Prabhupada also said that devotees should study the Roman Catholic Church. We say, why should we study the Catholic Church? They're all meat eaters. Well, that's true. But as a religious institution, it's superb. There's nothing like it in the world. 2,000 years, a lot of ups and downs, some really bad downs. Some of the popes were really, woo. Don't want to talk about them in the Bhagavatam class. I mean, really, not good people at all. But it's, Prabhupada said we should study, see how they've organized and survived and everything. And of course, they have, for hundreds of years, they were very politically involved, which we should try to avoid as at least the core of our movement, because Srila Prabhupada said this is a movement of brahmanas. So we may give advice. And devotees, they may be kings. No sign of it yet. But things can change, as we saw with the advent of the COVID-19. Things can change in the world radically very quickly. So if it can change radically very quickly by a little virus, if Krishna can also change things very quickly, and all of a sudden people are asking devotees, well, how do we organize society? What are we going to say? Are you ready to tell them? We should be ready. But as a movement, we should try to avoid political entanglement, and we don't want to get identify with any political party. Whoever's there, all right. Otherwise, we get involved in nationalism and and exploitation. And if we gravitate to one party, then people on the other side will criticize us. And we don't really belong on either side. We're on Krishna's side. Isn't that right? If we go with the right wing, and then, oh, you're for the people are exploiting. And if we go with the left wing seems much better. Communism, share everything with everyone. But that's totally... The right wing is for hierarchical society, which we are also, Varnashram, but a very different premise. But they tend to believe in God at least superficially. Whereas the left wing, it's humanism, there's no God there. Speaking in very general terms. Srila Prabhupada said about communism, he said, I just read this yesterday or the day before, that he said, communism, they think they'll change the world, but because they're all low-class people, they'll establish a low-class society. It's a movement of the Shudras, Prabhupada said. So we're not right-wing or left-wing, we're for Krishna. The right-wing, left-wing, they're all supporting slaughterhouses. How can we support any of them? But at a certain level, we may do. And we have to remember it's a certain level and don't go too much into it. Our real position is nearer picture. We're neutral. We're not with any group. Nearer picture na hoile dharma sthapa na jai. In Chaitanya Charitamrita it's stated, unless one is neutral, unless one doesn't take part in this side or that side in the material world, one cannot establish dharma, instead of trying to promote some political agenda. That was one of Harvey Cox's things. He said the church should change with the world. And at that time, in South America, there was a lot of liberation theology going on, in the sense that the priests thought that Marx's theory is very good with Jesus. That why are few people have all the money, we should be on the side of the proletariat. So Harvey Cox said, hey, look, that's the way the world is going. That's the way theology on ground level is going. Maybe we should go along with that. And he also said, you see, there's so much influence from the East, different religious and philosophical ideas. Let's have a look at that. Another one who was very much into looking East was Thomas Merton, who would have been a huge theological figure if he hadn't died at a young age. He also wrote a review, very nice review, for the first edition of Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita as it is. He died in Thailand. He was visiting Buddhists there and died of electric shock. So, we should keep it very clear, we have our own agenda. We may welcome the Prime Minister or whatever. We did also in Delhi, the Prime Minister of India came to open the Temple of ISKCON in Delhi. That was a huge thing, a nationally, internationally famous figure. And he came and was personally there. He didn't just come for 5 minutes, he stayed, he gave a speech. I was there. He was stepping out politically to do that because he actually liked the devotees very much. He knew them for many years. Prabhupada, when he was coming to our center in Juhu, even before the temple was opened, Prabhupada said to the devotee, in future, he'll be a very important man. Give him prasadam. Whenever he comes, give him prasadam. So he came, what should we say? No, we don't want you coming. We're not political. Sure, come on, please, very much. Very nice, come. Doesn't mean we follow everything that he says, but he is respected by so many people. He's an important person in the world. We are not. Actually, those who are preaching the message of Krishna consciousness, they are the most important people, but people don't recognize that. So, just like we're building a big temple, why are we doing that? We don't need that. We can just have a big shed. But if we have a big shed, people won't give any importance to it. So we build a big temple, which looks very impressive and is impressive, and then people like to come. So it's all part of preaching. That's the idea. At the same time, we have to know that we are supposed to be sarvopadivinirmuktam, free of all mundane designations. We don't have intrinsically anything to do with this party or that party or any other party. We shouldn't become part of anyone's program. We have our own program. We have our own social agenda. It's called Varnashram Dharma. We have to establish that. Anyway, there are just some points arising from this question. Hare Krishna. All glories to His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Oh, one more thing I should say in this regard. Srila Prabhupada used to quote a Bengali saying, when you go fishing, don't touch the water. In other words, you have to pull out the fish, not that the fish pulls you in. Hare Krishna. Vancha kalpa tarupyascha kripa sindhu evacha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo. Namo namaha.